Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Rob Wilkins talking about that literary phenomenon, Terry Pratchett.
That was very nice. Good morning all, and welcome to what I always consider to be the Charlie Higson slot. There we are.
He does the mornings.
Indeed. Shall I talk about zombies?
No.
Actually, you could
talk about zombies. There are zombies in the Discworld.
Well, I'll talk about them. I'm going to talk about you to start with. This is Stu Taylor. Stu
Hello.
Is... he's great. And the first time I... The first time I met Stu, he was moist, which to Discworld fans will mean something, and to non-Discworld fans, they're probably making for the exits.
Where did we meet?
Stu played Moist von Lipwig at the Studio Theatre in Salisbury, and a little provincial theatre, a very well-respected and well-attended theatre here in Salisbury, and played, and this is not me saying this, this is Terry saying this, the best Moist von Lipwig we ever saw, including Richard Coyle in the Sky adaptation.
Well,
and you were absolutely superb. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being moist.
Give it time, it's quite warm in here.
What, the leather seats?
Leather seats as well.
Yeah. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Rob. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you very
Excellent.
Much.
Excellent. Okay, so we're at the Chalk Valley History Festival. Terry lived in the Chalk Valley. It's beautiful countryside. How did it influence and inform on his work?
Wow. Hugely. Which
right.
is two words. Well, no, it's one word repeated. Okay. At the Cheltenham Literary Festival years ago, Terry was asked the question, how does Lynn influence your words? How does Lynn, your wife, influence your work? And Terry paused on stage at Cheltenham for a whole minute, which seemed about 10 years to the audience, and just sat there pondering it. And then he came out with this. He said, asking me how Lynn influences my writing, and I've gone goosebumpy just thinking about it.
I do all the time.
Is like asking how the oceans influence the fishes. And I just sat there in the audience, and I was making notes, and I stopped what I was doing. I thought, that is the most perfect answer. So in answer to what you've just said, asking me how the Chalk Valley influenced Terry's writing is like asking how the oceans influence the fishes, because it was all around him every day, and this is the place he loved. And so it influenced him more than anything.
And he moved here quite early on when he was writing the Discworld books.
December 93.
93. And what book was he writing?
He'd just finished Soul Music. So he was just... Soul Music had probably been sent off. In fact, to be honest, he was probably bored stiff of Soul Music at the point in December 93, which I think came out... It was spring the year following. So he was working on Interesting Times. He might have even just about be finished in working on Interesting Times and be in the honeymoon period of the next.
Right.
Because the thing with Terry is that the book that he was writing now was completely different to the book, obviously, that you were going to go and buy in the shops. And so the book that he was promoting was probably two behind the one he was working on. So he was actually bored out of his head of the book that you were queuing up with, because he'd read it and edited it and it had been polished.
It's finished, it's done, the
it's
next
done.
One, then the next one.
That was it. So he was working on, at least he was working on Interesting Times, but he was probably working on Carpe Jugulum by then. He was probably thinking so far ahead.
Yeah. So the majority of the Discworld books were written in the Chalk Valley.
Do you know, I think we can safely say that.
Yeah.
Obviously, at the end of Terry's life, certainly after the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and I know I'm jumping forward, it became obvious that we either answered all the mail or we went down to one book a year. And that was pretty much what happened. So for a bloke with a degenerative brain disorder still knocking out a bestseller every year, it's still a fantastic feat. So in those early days, he was writing two books a year.
Yeah.
And you think of the process, sitting down, writing, editing, taking it out on the road and touring it, meeting all of you, while actually still writing the next book or the book after that. It was phenomenal. He worked so hard. And he did a lot of it here.
And doing the research as well, because he was a big, I've seen the library and it's just full of random books.
Okay, question for you then. What was your favourite book that you saw in there?
Vegetable Dying.
Vegetable Dying.
And that's not what you think. That's not murdering vegetables. That's using vegetables to die.
Yes.
And I had a quick flick through it. Oh, and The History of Snot.
Yeah.
There's another one.
That's a particular favourite of mine, because I was going to say the history of false teeth. It just has to be a favourite one of mine.
Well, of course.
So, yeah. No, the research. I was asked a question the other day, someone was trying to sort of pick up the hook between history and fantasy. And this is a history festival, and Terry was a fantasy author. But the important thing to know about Terry's writing, if there's anybody here who hasn't read a Terry Pratchett book, firstly, I implore you to do so. And secondly, I know it will be completely different to what you expect. Because as Terry said, you throw in one sodding dragon, and they call it
well,
fantasy.
This is it. Everybody thinks fantasy fiction, you know, stick a guy in a loincloth with a magic sword and a talking horse, and the rest of it just writes itself.
Actually, write that one down. That's brilliant.
Brilliant. No, no. Brilliant. Copyright.
I'll buy that.
But actually, it was satire.
Yes.
And it was the sharpest form of satire. And if you're doing satire, you have to do your research.
At the beginning of the Black in Black documentary, Colin Smythe put it quite, Terry's agent, ex-agent, said he skewers his intended victim. Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use that as mine now on.
Well, like you said, when you were writing Unseen Academicals, two people who have no interest in football whatsoever suddenly had to do a load of research about football.
Oh, to say that we had no interest in football is zero. Terry said that as a provincial journalist, he covered every single job that a provincial journalist could undertake except Saturday afternoon football. But the whole thing, Unseen Academicals, I know we're jumping around, but the whole thing with the research is that Unseen Academicals came about because I was going through a file on our computer called the Pit, and Terry asked me if I could find anything interesting in there. And a lot of the Pit was fragments of ideas and snapshots and things that probably never would have turned into a full-length novel. And then I came across the Hunt the Megapode scene, which I won't even bother trying to describe to any of you that haven't read it. But it was this fully formed lump of text set in Unseen University, and it was absolutely perfect. And the bit that you end up with in the novel at the beginning of Unseen Academicals is almost exactly that piece from the Pit. So he said, right, I know what I'm going to do with that. I know what I'm going to do with it. And I must admit, I'd been hoping for another Moise von Littwig novel, as I was right the way through until we decided on Shepherd's Crown at the end. Still praying for another
Shepherd's
Moise novel.
Shepherd's Crown's a great one to finish.
It is great, but yeah. I still...
I think they work as a trilogy. And I've just read Raising Steam, and that brings home the research that you have to do. I mean,
well, there's another one. I was going to say about, with Unseen Academicals, we knew nothing. So we were phoning up everybody and saying, here, do you know what the offside rule is? And it's surprising how many conflicting offside rules that you get. So we decided the offside rule that we could make up in the office was probably far more interesting than the real one.
I couldn't explain it.
That was going to be my next question.
No, well, there you go then. I'm not going to explain it.
But Raising Steam was an interesting one as well, because obviously Steam was going to change the face of Ankh-Morpork, whichever way you looked at it. Terry said this. He said, steam engines will happen when it's steam engine time.
Yeah.
So at no point during the history of the world could steam engines have happened apart from when they happened and kicked off the Industrial Revolution. Yeah. They weren't going to happen in the 11th century or the 12th century. It was going to happen when it was steam engine time.
Yeah.
And I think maybe looking back, and I can say this because Terry isn't sitting beside me, maybe there should have been a couple of more books before we got to Raising Steam. Maybe Running Water, which was going to be another one of the Moise von Littwig novels, which was going to be basic. Moise was going to be Joseph Bazalgette in Ankh-Morpork. I mean, how good would that... Oh, I can taste it. How good would that have been? But it wasn't to be. And Raising Taxes. That was going to be another one.
Was it?
Yeah. He was going to be a tax inspector.
Just ticking off all of those boring jobs, bank manager, tax inspector.
But let's think about it, though. Moise von Littwig, as a tax inspector, he could get people to pay taxes, and they would feel damn glad and happy
that's
that
true.
They're, that they're
is true,
doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got inside Moise's head better than anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did some research on Running Water, and we actually went down into a sewer. I was about to say over near Wincanton, and I thought, if I stumble on that sentence, we went down into a sewer that is Wincanton, but and for the Discworld fans, they know what I'm saying regarding that. And I can see Mrs. Boggis in the aisle there who lives there. I didn't mean that. But we went over and we went down into a sewer, and Terry just could not believe how beautiful the brickwork was
yeah.
and the tile work and all of that was. So the thing with Terry's research, all of that, you know, the broad strokes, but also the fine detail. So yeah. So the other day when I was describing about fantasy and history and the way that it collided in Terry's world, is that sometimes a historian would have to paint with the broad strokes to give you general ideas, but Terry could hone down on the history of snot and give you details on that are absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that you wouldn't have thought to ask.
You wouldn't have thought to ask.
Because what is the history of snot? It's always been around,
come
right?
Back to the office and read it.
I'll read it. I'll borrow it.
But it made its way into the books. I know exactly how it made its way into the books.
Oh, go on,
in snuff, the goblins had ungu pots that they kept. I hate to say this, they didn't throw anything away bodily away, and they kept it all in little jars. And one of them would have been their pot of snot. I hope you've all had your breakfast.
We'll be selling pots of snot later.
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. A good idea for Discworld.com. There we are. But we were down, talking about that, we were down in a silver mine. We went over to the Discworld convention years ago in Arizona, and we took a day out with Terry, and we took him down to Tombstone. And he was cool. Always so fascinated with the OK Corral and Wyatt Earp. And the thing for Terry about the OK Corral, that he loved the fact that his granddad could have met Wyatt Earp. Because we all know, sitting here, that the gunfight at the OK Corral happened a million years ago. That was so long ago. But it wasn't so long ago. And his granddad could have met Wyatt Earp. And that's fascinating. So we took him down there to go and see the place where the gunfight happened, and two things happened that afternoon. One of them was that they'd actually closed it for the day by the time we got there. In fact, three things happened. My favourite thing was that, as a team, and some of them are here in the room, we all dressed up in our cowboy gear.
Brilliant.
And we had our photograph taken. You know the ones they do for tourists?
Sepia, lovely.
Yeah, we had that. But my favourite thing that happened in the day is that when we headed back up towards Phoenix, we were actually pulled over by the Border Patrol. They were looking for Mexicans. And they found mad Discworld fans instead, who did nothing but talk to them. Sorry, talk at them. If you want to get through border control, honestly, if the Mexicans work out
friendly.
The Mexicans work out, all you need to do is read Terry Pratchett books and talk at the TSA guards. That's it. Trump won't need a wall, honestly. He'll just close down bookshops. Oh, my God. He's
okay.
Sorry, I just...
No, that's not. That's just a step. No.
He is going to do that, isn't he? Oh, sorry.
Right, let's bring it back to the Chalk Valley. You told me a story when you and Terry were walking through the fields and you sat down and he basically explained the We Free Men.
The We Free Men, to those initiated. Well, there's a We Free person over there. Please stand up, We Free person. Well done, you. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you for that. That's made my day. Well, you know exactly where you are, because we walked out of the chapel, Terry's writing room, which is recreated just over there, and we sat down to have our lunch. And Terry started telling me about the We Free Men. But a quick footnote to that is that Terry had his birthday, and for his birthday, Paul had given him a life-size Rob Anybody. He'd sculpted it. Okay, so footnoting my footnote, Paul Kidby, freaking genius that he is, not only can he paint and draw, he can actually... that he has now sculpted a life-size Rob Anybody. Most important thing, life-size. There we go. So this is a very big Nat McFeagle over here. he'd sculpted Rob Anybody. Now, the We Free Men... Oh, there we are. There he is. Oh. So for those of you who don't know who the Nat McFeagle are, there they are, life-size against a big Tiffany Aching. Paul had sculpted Rob. The Nat McFeagle were just bit part characters in Carpe Jugulum, which was published in 1998. And now Paul comes along for Terry's birthday and gives him a Rob Anybody, and it blows Terry's mind. And he starts telling himself the stories of the Nat McFeagle. And we walk out just over there, less than a mile away over there. And Terry sits down and starts telling me the stories of the We Free Men and the Nat McFeagle. And it was absolutely fascinating. And I have so many proud moments with Terry, and this isn't me blowing my own trumpet, but Rob Anybody being named Rob Anybody is, that's one of my
good,
my
man.
I love it. Better than Willikins. I'm very
happy. Willikins is good. It works.
I'm very happy with that. But he told me the stories. And Terry said that in his peripheral vision, he could see the blue blurs that were the Nac McPheagle. And he could see them running around.
And just
around.
Sitting there with the hill rolling over and fields and trees and sheep and all that lot and just painting that picture.
If you haven't been into the Shed of Doom yet, the Shed of Doom, we'll get onto it in a minute, but the Shed of Doom is great and the office is recreated. But for me, the most touching part for me, and I hope for you, that we've recreated over the last few weeks, is Terry Shepherd's hut. Now, that really is Terry Shepherd's hut. And he bought that long before David Cameron tried to make... before David Person made them tried to make them popular. And I'm sorry about that. I really just... it wasn't meant to be the noise.
Later. Sorry about that.
So, yes, before people made them trendy, Terry had one. And what did he have a shepherd's hut for? He had a shepherd's hut so Pat, our shepherdess, could have somewhere to sleep when she was looking after the lambs. He bought a shepherd's hut for a shepherdess. And I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
But over the last week, Paul Kibbe's wife, Vanessa, has turned the shepherd's hut into Granny Aching's shepherd's hut. And just put your head through there and draw in a deep breath and smell the lavender.
The first thing I said when I put my eyes, like, it smells amazing in here. Yeah,
it really
it's beautiful.
Was.
Go and have a look.
And picture Terry at the window. Okay, he wouldn't be sitting there with an A4 pad writing it down, but picture him at the window with a keyboard. And that's where Tiffany Aching, that's where the We Three Men were born. And that's thanks to Paul Kibbe. Absolutely thanks
and
to
it's
Paul
a beautiful. I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of machinery.
Yeah.
Furniture.
Yeah.
I'd
prefer it with a bigger, obviously with a V8 engine in the back, or a V10 engine, obviously. But it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, and it's really been brought to life over the last couple of weeks.
And you mentioned the Shed of Doom, of course, towering over the Chalk Valley History Festival.
I am so proud.
It's really good.
Ask me why. Go on, ask me why.
Rob.
Stu. Sorry, I forgot I was here.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was in a reverie as well. Why did you do the Shed of Doom?
I don't know. I will tell you why. Since Terry died, before Terry died, we were inundated with people with ideas for projects, whether it's film and TV or physical things that people want to do. I mean, when I mean inundated, I mean absolutely inundated. And if you come to me and you say, I've got this great idea, Discworld wallpaper. Actually, that's not a bad idea.
Just
Disco wallpaper. I really want to do this. And and immediately I'm thinking, oh, the setup and the blah, blah. And you're thinking the problems there. Put it on upside down and it'll be embarrassing.
Yeah.
Paul Kibbe turns to me at the history. Not the History Festival because that's where we are. At the His World exhibition.
Yes.
And we were talking about what we were going to do here. And he said, what we need to do, the entrance into the tent of horrors. why don't we recreate Evil Harry Dredd's Shed of Doom? And it's one of those things you just think, yes, absolutely, yes, yes.
It seems so easy when you just say it like that.
It is. You don't need to know anything more. It's a Shed of Doom. It's going to be 23 foot high, and it's not going to look like Evil Harry Dredd's Shed of Doom. It is his Shed of Doom. We have pulled it up out of Lamidos, and we have pulled it over here, and here it is.
Yeah.
We have got the Shed of Doom here. And that was it. And can I just say one thing before I go on? The team of people behind that, honestly, I'd like to claim, obviously, ownership that I did it all myself, which is actually entirely true, but Actually, I was 5,500 miles away working on Good Omens when that went up. But the team of people behind the Shed of Doom, from Richard and Chris, who actually, I was about to call them chippies, which is a huge insult. they're not chippies. They are master craftsmen.
They are
cabinet makers. They are absolutely what they can do. Wood is one material I don't understand. Give me a couple of bits of metal and I can work
weld
it out.
Weld it.
Yeah, I can weld it.
You're a welder.
That's it. My dad taught me a couple of life skills, welding and spray painting, and that's
brilliant.
It. If he'd have shown me how to bang a nail into a piece of wood, we'd have had it all.
There are other people.
So
for that.
Richard and Chris, I mean, what an amazing thing they've done. I mean, Paul Kibbe's drawing, what an amazing job. Harry, who's here in the front row from Kismet Photography, who's now, I think we've kind of completely taken over your business and swamped it. But Harry without Harry, the Shed of Doom would probably be in three sections on the floor because we wouldn't have been allowed to actually erect it. So Harry had to deal with everything. And Alex over there behind the camera. Alex is part of our team, and that, actually, I don't know if his in-laws are actually in the tent at the moment, but I'm going to tell you something embarrassing.
here you go, Al.
They've come down for the weekend to visit because Alex is getting married next year. Hooray! Well done! And up until this weekend, he's told them he's a dentist. So, but he's not, and he does all sorts of things for us. So I want to say, and in fact, you've just given Alex a round of applause, for everybody who's had anything to do with the Shed of Doom, from Paul Kibbe, Harry, Richard, Chris, everybody, Sonia, who's in there, Aidan, from me, a big round of applause for all of them, because it's brilliant. Oh. So that's why A Shed of Doom.
Yes.
Evil Harry Dredd, for those of you, I keep saying for those of you who don't know, honestly, for those of you who don't know, start at the beginning and just by the end, by the time I see you next year, please read
you'll
everything.
You'll be well up on it.
Harry,
don't worry.
Evil Harry Dredd is to Dark Lords what Pete Best was to the Beatles. He left the other Dreadlords before they got famous. He's a very low rent. He is a bargain basement Dreadlord, okay? And all he could afford was his shed.
But it's impressive when you look at it. When you go in it.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I really
love
it.
There's so many. Look up, by the way, when you go
yes,
in. Look
yeah,
up
no,
as well.
Don't,
you have
to don't just walk through it.
No.
It's good. Really good.
Ask me what I'm going to do with it afterwards.
I thought I was having it.
Oh, sorry. That's exactly what I was going to say.
You said I could
have it. It's going in your front
garden.
Yeah, there we are.
Is that all right? Brilliant.
There we are. You have a tent full of people who have now acknowledged that Claire has actually said you can have it in your front garden. There we
yeah.
are.
Yeah. No, what are you going to do with it?
I don't know.
I'm sure someone will have it off, yeah?
Okay. I don't like social media. The reason I don't like social media is that sometimes you feel that we're all here together, and you've all made an effort to come here, and which I appreciate more than I can begin to tell you. And you're all here. And sometimes I wish that we could all have like a little secret between us. And Terry used to quite enjoy that. He'd have a secret with the fans, but social media now means that you can't
It'll
your
be out, yeah.
Everything you say goes yeah. out there. But at the top of the Terry and Rob Twitter feed, it does actually say something along the lines of, we've got to go away and dream it all up again, okay?
Yeah.
So let me say here and now, because the first time I've actually sat up in front of anybody since the award-winning His World
yes,
exhibition.
Yes, I mean,
that
if
phenomenal.
You didn't see the His World exhibition, you missed a treat there. It was fantastic, wasn't it?
Well, it was the same team behind the Shed of Doom. Yeah. I mean, there's no stopping them, honestly.
No, they're on it now. What's the next thing?
Life-size recreation of the whole of Discworld.
Brilliant.
I'll go
and see that.
The only thing I want a roller coaster around yes. around the Tower of Art. Oh, that's a Helter Skelter, isn't it? Helter Skelter.
Yes.
There we go. Yes. Do you get that?
Oh,
see
I'm
that?
Excited for this. When's this happening?
Right. Well, we want to do something. If I talk about the next exhibition and I tell you its code name, it would kind of give away when we're hoping it's going to be.
Right. Okay.
And I don't want to say that now in case people start trying to buy tickets for it. But are we going to do something after His World?
Are you?
Damn right we are.
Good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yes, yes. Yes. But are we going to tour His World? No, we're not.
No.
Shall I tell you why?
Why?
Ask me why.
Why are you not going to tour His World?
Because occasionally I would actually like my desk back so I can work here. Be quite nice.
I thought there was a big hole in the
room. There was a big hole in the office.
Something's missing.
Whoever, if anybody thinks that for His World that we actually we knocked up a few spares, you know. Yeah. And
IKEA desk, you know.
You can actually buy that in IKEA. But we didn't. We actually dismantled the office and we moved it into Salisbury Museum. And I thought the Salisbury Museum exhibition would be one of those things that would be quite jolly
yeah.
and a few people would come along and it would come and it would go. On the day it opened, I made the mistake. I was told to drive around the back of the museum, and I made the mistake of driving past the front of the museum, and they had those snaky barrier things. And who was it? I think Jason and Rachel were standing at the front from Discworld Monthly, and there was nobody else. There was nobody else. And I drove my car back, and I didn't want to look. I didn't want to look. And I think now there was Jason and Rachel and another person. And it's going to open in 20 minutes. So, I can't believe this. No one's going to come. I am my father's son. Whatever we went to, my father would believe nobody else was going. You go to the British Grand Prix, and my father would be, it's quite busy. It's quite busy. So, always thinking he was going to be the only person there. And I drove around the back of the museum. I went in, and they took me up to what they'd called their green room, which I think was the
toilet.
The toilet, yeah. But it overlooked the main square, and I could see that there was only Jason and Rachel, and now one other person and a puppy. Yeah. And I was.
No dogs
worried.
Allowed in, though. That's no dogs. That's the killer.
No, there was only going to be three allowed in. That was good. And I can't believe this. They're really, nobody's going to turn up. Everyone's going to hate it, and it's going to be all really horrible. And so I went for a wander, and I just had a little moment looking into the office, and I had this moment of complete calm, just thinking, actually, whoever comes, they're going to love this, because this is actually Terry's office. We've recreated it. There's a couple of things because of space that it's not as big, and we've compacted it down. There's a few bits in there that weren't actually in the office that we've moved in from the library, and all of that I admit. But actually, as a thing, the shelving and everything, it all is perfect. And I had a little moment with Terry, and he told me it was all going to be all right. And I walked out, and I had to go and say a few words as I opened the door. And there's now 300 people out there. and I don't know, they must have parachuted in. Within 10 minutes, the whole place was busy.
And it was like that the entire exhibition.
21,000 people over that time. It was the biggest single exhibition that they have ever had.
Yeah.
And spread over that time. And then it went off and it won an award. I feel really bad. It beat the Bowie exhibition, for heaven's sake.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
I know.
Dear.
I'm sorry.
We'll do it slightly worse
next time.
All right, cheers.
I'm so sorry.
And then you did the Imaginarium signing in the Salisbury Museum as well, didn't you, with Paul, the book?
Again, Paul and myself thinking that people are going to be really disappointed after they've queued up for 4 hours and they get to the front of the queue and they realise it's me and Paul and not Terry.
That was good.
Awkward.
I queued up.
Do you know what I was going to do if people got to the front of the queue and they were disappointed that Terry wasn't there? Tell me that is not. So honestly, look at that.
I used to have a beard. It looked a lot better.
There you go.
Nice hat, man.
Thank you. Terry's bowler. I always tried to bring a hat along because obviously Terry's black hat was Terry. And I didn't know which one to bring today, so I took a top hat home last night. And I looked at it and thought, no, actually, if we're here in the Chalk Valley, talking to you lot, it's got to be Terry's bowler. So that is Terry's bowler. And for the locals here, that I'm sure that many of you will have seen him walking around with his wellies on and his gardening trousers and jacket and his bowler hat. And that was Terry. He just used to walk and walk and walk.
Beautiful. So the future. I know it's a history festival, but we can talk about the future, right?
Yeah, because the future will be history at some point. So
that's deep, man. That's really cool. Wow, okay, yeah. Wow. Blew my mind. So, Good Omens, the TV series.
Yeah.
Exciting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Very.
How's it going?
Fine.
Good.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to talk about it?
No, it's fine. That was it. No, that's it. That's all of it.
That was taken just over there as well, by the way, that photograph. Let me just quickly tell you while it's on the screen. I've always got a big camera. I'm always walking around with an SLR. That day, we were walking down to the little church in Firefield, Bavan. And those Discworld fans of you who are visitors, I implore you to go and have a look at it. It's a 12th century church. It's the second smallest church in the country. And Terry put the roof back on it.
Yeah.
It was a village effort, but Terry was one of the... And that house there, again, is a mile over there. There we are. That's the Doomsday Manoret. But that photograph, we were walking down to Firefield Bavan Church, and Terry leant on the gate and was waiting for me to catch up. And suddenly the light was perfect, everything was perfect. And before the days of mobile phones with cameras, I had a little £100 Sony point and click in my pocket, and I took it out and took a couple of pictures of it. And the light was so perfect. And I put it away for ages, ages and ages and ages. And then the publishers asked me, did I have any pictures of Terry? And I had a look at that memory card that was on the, or memory stick as it was Sony. And and there it was, that picture. And I didn't realize that what I considered to be, that's my mate, that photograph that was up there, that's Terry. And the one thing that none of you know, that when you look at that picture, is that I can look at his lips and I realize he was going, come on, get on with it, let's take the picture, are you taking it yet? There you go, right, now can we move? There we are. So the three photographs before and after that are,
It's starting to punch you.
Before I answer Good Omens, can I say one more thing about the
van? Yes, of course you can.
Terry was, Terry, we've established how much he loved this place. Mm. And he did so much for the Chalk Valley, a lot more than I think even the residents of the Chalk Valley. The school, he was one of the largest benefactors when Broadchalk School moved just down the road. And then in the last few years, the Disqual Foundation actually put the solar panels on the roof of the school. Again, by stealth. The Village Hub, when Lord Robert Fry of Broadchalk moved his village, well, closed his village shop, we didn't know where it was going to go and what was going to happen. Again, the Disqual Foundation stepped in and did that. The roof of Firefield Bavan Church, Ebbsbourne Wake Church, all of those projects were either Disqual Foundation or Terry himself. And why would an atheist want to put the roof back on a church? Because that's what Englishmen do. That's what Terry said. And I really like that. Terry had no belief whatsoever, but restoring a church was really very important. And none of that was avoiding the question about Good Omens, I promise you.
You don't want to talk about Good Omens?
I'll talk about Good Omens. Yeah,
okay.
It is going incredibly well. We've actually, I keep repeating, but for those of you who don't know, so we've been filming Good Omens for what seemed like 10 years. we filmed for 109 days, and that included pickups and bits and bobs. We filmed here in the UK, and then we went over to South Africa and filmed in South Africa for God only knows
Seems
how long.
Seems like a long time.
And then we wrapped, and then we've done some pickups, and now it's actually in the cutting room as we speak. Last night, Neil Gaiman sent me a text that said, "Let me know what you think of the latest cut of episode one." I said, "I haven't received it yet," and then I went. There's special software that are called Pix, that is where the cutting room can send up all the different cuts and as it's happening. And I looked on Pix, and there it is. So rather than, I wouldn't rather be anywhere than here, but I really ought to be at home with Sandra watching episode one of Good Omens, because it's just been recut. I was in Los Angeles in Hollywood, because that's what I do
look
now,
you,
Stu.
Look at you.
That's what I do,
that's
honestly.
Cute.
The Chalk Valley.
And Hollywood.
And we were there with Amazon watching the first episodes, and jointly, as a collective, knocking it into shape. That's
excellent.
What we did.
And it's going to be on Amazon, and then it's going to be on the BBC? Because I don't have Amazon Prime.
You don't? Well, then no, you'll just have to wait a few months.
Well, can you send me that edit? You can just email that across to me. Like that.
I'll tell you what I'll do. Privately, I'm going I'll stick it up on YouTube later.
Oh, that's
I won't.
Yeah.
I won't mention it.
Yeah, that's fine. Just send me the link and it'll be fine. Yeah, no one else will see that. Absolutely, 100%.
Nobody else is interested. Look at them. They're not bothered at all. Good Omens singularly is one of the, well, it has been amazing fun. It's been amazing fun. But it takes so long to get it to the point where the cameras are rolling. Years go by and on the surface, nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. And yet, the amount of sleepless nights. I'm looking at Sandra when I'm saying this. It's a huge process, isn't it? And you've seen me through the highs and the lows. The lows being me desperately wanting a particular piece of casting and always bang your head against the wall, because Amazon, obviously, they're putting in a huge amount of money into it. A huge, massive. The Sky movies were right, a footnote. The Sky movies, what Terry loved about the Sky adaptations is that they could make $5 look like $50 on screen by using ingenuity when the money ran out. And he loved that.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
Whereas Amazon would like $50 to look like $500 on screen using ingenuity and, in fact, a load more. Let's just tip a load of 50s over it and make it look even better, because they want it to look the best it can possibly look. And all of that takes a phenomenal amount of time.
Yeah.
And even being in part of the process, you realise that today you're filming on Birdcage Walk, and tomorrow you're at an airfield in Oxfordshire. And all of that stuff, the catering, the loos, the changing rooms and all of the costumes and makeup and hair, all of that has to move overnight. So somebody, because I'm quite sort of retentive about such things, I stand and I think about everybody has had to have had their call sheet with their orders to move it. It's a massive, massive thing.
Yeah, a military operation.
Oh, more than that, honestly. We could invade Bishopstone with the knowledge that we now have. Honestly,
Should we do that later on when we finish here?
Today, Bishopstone. Tomorrow, the world.
There's a tank out there. We could hijack that. That'd be all right.
I actually have brought one thing from Good Omens actually here. So I don't know if you can you
I
see.
Did,
what,
I did have
can
a
you see what it says on there? You can read it out.
To Rob, wear these well, David Tennant.
He's the one. Shall I show you what he gave me? I'm very pleased with these. I stole several props from the set of Good Omens. When I said stole, you know the motorbikes, the four horsemen of the, or the four bikers of the apocalypse?
Did you steal a motorbike?
No, because that would be singular.
I was going to say a pair of sunglasses, but a motorbike.
There you go. First time in public. There we go. There we go. Throw me some.
They are good. They're really good, man.
I'm going to wear these for the rest of the day.
Do it.
Oh, that's quite spooky. The only other person who have worn these is probably the costume lady and David Tennant. There we go. I'm putting those away. There we go. Go on, then. Go on, then.
Are they prescription?
No. Looking good. There we go.
They're really cool.
They are good, aren't they?
Awesome.
Oh, and I can't tell you where they came from because you'll all go out and buy them.
Merchandising for when the TV series comes out. Everyone will want to buy a pair of them.
I actually had a merchandising meeting the other day about Good Omens. Because Ooh. To me, because I was brought up, let's talk about history again. Star Wars, obviously, that's ancient history.
Yeah, let's
history
talk about
now.
Star Wars.
That's ancient history. Well, Star Wars completely changed my life. I'm sure that almost all of you here in 1977 went to see Star Wars. But for me, I sat down in the Novair Theatre in Norwich. My father had been working away throughout the whole time of the build-up and then the first screenings. All my friends have seen it. I've got the book, but I didn't want to see it until I was there with my dad. Cool. And I went to see it, and the little Rebel shuttle goes over, and then the big Imperial destroyer. And in that moment, my life changed because I want to do that. That's what. I want to do that. That's what I want to do. I want to do that. So I went back home, and I wrote the sequel to Star Wars. Yeah, I wrote the sequel to Star Wars. And a couple of years later, what was it,
80 was 80, Empire yep. Strikes Back.
So there I am in the Novair Theatre with my dad watching The Empire Strikes Back. And dear God almighty, George Lucas has broken into my bedroom and stolen my story. And there it was. Because I had set my sequel on an ice planet. But let's be obvious.
Excellent.
Let's be honest here. I mean, a 12-year-old, as I would have been at the time, I was either going to set it on an ice planet or a fire planet, wasn't I? Oh. But because I'd chosen an ice planet, and there it was.
And just like that. Fantastic. You're linked into this, like, well, you know, you could publish that, couldn't you? You know some publishers.
Yes, indeed.
It'd be an alternate timeline for Star Wars.
Did you know we're our own publisher now? Did you know that?
No,
go
are
on,
you?
Ask me the question. Yeah.
Rob.
Yes,
are you? Are you your own publisher now?
Funny you should ask me that, Stu.
Wow. Well,
Narrativia is the company that looks after the TV, film, digital and merchandising of Terry's, of all the works. And we needed another vehicle to look after all the publishing rights after Terry died. And that's Dunn Manifestin, which we thought was highly appropriate. For those of you who don't know, Dunn Manifestin is the home of the gods. And therefore, that's it.
Publishing.
So we look after it. And so the what we realized is that we have been asked, or we've been commissioned by the publishers, the Discworld Imaginarium that was out last year.
Yes.
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I look at Harry while I'm saying this. Harry sat in far too many meetings where the publishers are arguing the toss over 40p. It was 40p, wasn't it? The goal blocking, well, we could do it like this, but it's going to mean another 40p per copy. And we thought, actually, do you know what? We could do this ourselves.
Right.
And I don't give a damn about 40p a copy because I know that 40p a copy will actually look like £50 to all of you when you're actually holding the book.
Yes.
So the super duper wonderful edition of the Imaginarium.
The one in the
clam. It really is a thing to behold. And okay, it's £100, but you're getting a book that's worth £500, says a bloke who buys books at £500 and looks at it and thinks, that's worth £100. The Discworld Imaginarium is basically the history of Paul Kidby's Discworld artwork from the beginning.
And it's utterly beautiful.
It is
gorgeous. When I came back from the signing, I just didn't like Claire. I just sat and cover to cover. 3 hours just staring at these things and looking at this. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
It is gorgeous. And we decided that we were going to publish the special edition ourselves. We're actually working right now. Harry's working on, is it three publications or four? Four? It's four. We're working on four more publications. And one of them, I think the code name is, we've got the super duper edition, we've got the super duper duper edition, and the one that's actually bound in human skin. Is that the...
Ooh. Where'd you get human skin from nowadays? Ah!
Silence of the Lambs, honestly.
Yeah, of course.
If you want the book, you have to provide. There we go. So there will be numbered editions, and then there will be lettered editions. But unfortunately, some bugger decided that they were going to use the Greek alphabet rather than
Arabic. Oh, that's confusing, isn't it, for stupid people like me?
Well, it is, but you lose two letters, you see, so there we are.
Oh, right.
So there we go. So, yeah, we're working on all of those. And those, because nobody is asking us to pull in the budget and... do you really, really need to put real brass clasps on the book? Yes, we do. Because how else will you keep the magic in there?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to tell you what that is, but I think at the Discworld convention this year, I think we're going to announce what those, at least what a couple of those projects are.
Cool.
That's fantastic.
That's really cool.
Did you know that some bugger steamrolled Terry's...
I heard that. Where did I see that? It was on the news.
You saw it everywhere.
And it was at the Downton Steam Festival, wasn't it?
It was at the...
No,
whatever it's called.
Not the Cuckoo Fair.
There's a big steam fair over there.
Dorset! I knew we began with a D.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
After we've taken Bishopstone, we're taking Dorset.
Keep expanding out from here,
it's
I think.
Fine, it's fine. The Dorset Steam Fair,
yeah, what was... Why did that happen then, didn't it?
Well, Terry had made it very clear that he would like all of his unpublished works to either be fired into space or steamrolled. We didn't have a rocket, but we did have a steam fair. And it was a morning when I was having a very difficult call about Good Omens. And I was talking to Neil the whole journey from the house to, from home, over to the Dorset Steam Fair, losing the signal 20 times on the way. We all know what it's like here in the valley. And eventually I've got Neil, I'm standing in the field, and I'm walking in circles around the car. And they kept nudging me and saying, it's actually up, the steam roller is actually up to steam. If you don't go and do it now, we can't do it. And I was that close. And thank Terry for actually forcing me to hang up the phone, which, as Sandra will tell you, is an impossible thing. But I did. I hung up the call, and I was muttering and groaning. I went across. The hard drive was given to me. I would like to say it was on some kind of a satin cushion, but it wasn't. There we go. There's a steamroller. There's the hard drive. Let's throw it underneath. And we did. We crushed it. But have you any idea? Has anybody else in the room tried to crush a hard drive with a steamroller? It's actually really difficult. It's really difficult because it kept just pushing it down. It just kept pushing it down.
Oh, no.
And do you know what? If there was an important piece of work in there, what could not be more important than Terry's work? But, okay, if your school project was on there and you've got to hand it in on Monday, hard drive would...
Oh, it would disintegrate. It would
Absolutely.
Just explode into a million pieces.
But no.
Yeah, but you backed it all up anyway, didn't you? And you kept it somewhere on floppy disk, right? Somewhere.
Sorry, lovely view, sorry.
Okay.
Did somebody say in the cloud? No.
That'd be dangerously keeping it in a cloud.
The only cloud it's on is the one that Terry is sitting on with his big white robes saying it's mine. But how about this for an idea? Just an idea.
Just throwing things out.
I'm going to put it out here now because I genuinely want a reaction to this. So I've made a solemn promise to the governor that I'm never going to... Those words, they are preserved now across gravel at the Dorset Steam Fair. They will never be published. No one will ever finish them and in my lifetime. Whether the grandchildren will want to finish them, I don't know. That will be out of my control. But during my lifetime, they will not be finished. But I had an idea that I thought might honour Terry's words without me really going against his word. And I thought maybe Paul Kidby would like to do the cover artwork for the 10 novels that I know exist.
Yes.
And I thought, actually, that's quite a good idea. I thought we could do a book of jackets of the unfinished unpublished novels. And then Paul, as he always does, Paul does this thing. He comes to visit me in the office, and he it's always show and tell time. And he comes in to show me something new that he's drawn or painted. And it's always so much better than you could have ever imagined. And you have a moment of jumping out of the chair and going, yes, he's done it again. It's brilliant. Shed of Doom being appointed president. It's perfect. And I mentioned this idea to Paul. So what do you think of this idea? How about graphic novels with the fragments of the ideas, but a graphic novel with no words? What do you reckon? Yeah? Yeah?
Yeah.
That was all right, yeah?
Yeah. I think people are really getting it.
That's just
I like the idea of the covers, though.
Do you like that?
Because you've got the titles, and you've got who would be in them.
The thing with Paul is that he hid so much in the covers. I mean, There's a very, very, that's The Wee Free Men. There we are. That's the book of the Nacma Fiegel, the first book of Tiffany Akins. So there we've got Tiffany, and then around the bottom, absolutely beautiful, the shepherd's crowns around there, absolutely just gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful cover. But for me, the thing that Paul hides there is not just the fact there's a Nacma Fiegel on her shoulder. The thing that's hidden in plain sight is Tiffany's strength. So she's 9 years old. And I know you can't see it at the back, but come and have a look later. The thing for me is her clenched fist.
Yeah.
The power in Tiffany as a wannabe witch is not the fact that she's holding a frying pan waiting to clobber
it's
Jenny Greenteeth. It's the power in that fist. And Paul does that. Paul does that. Now, they think it's a good idea that we
do. They
do.
They obviously do.
You can't call that half-hearted. There you go. Thank you all for coming. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the History Festival. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.